Welcome to the ADAA podcast about pediatric pain-related functional gastrointestinal disorders. Today we're talking with Dr. Carolyn Elder-Danda, who is a staff psychologist at the Kansas City Center for Anxiety Treatment in Overland Park, Kansas. Good morning, Dr. Danda. Let me ask you the first question. Can you explain the term pediatric pain-related functional gastrointestinal disorders and give some examples?
I sure can. Functional basically means that it's not caused by a structural, biochemical, or any kind of physiological or psychological disorder. Essentially, there's no blood and pus disease associated with those symptoms. It's an alteration in the way the body is sensing things or working. So we can think about functional being like the quarterback before the big game who throws up. Well, you know, that's actually a real symptom, but it's not due to blood or pus disease. It may be due to, obviously, excitement or nervousness, and that would be an example of a functional symptom.
Okay, it's much like a performer who has stage fright, who might vomit before a big performance, mm-hmm. The same kind of thing? Okay, is there a typical profile of children who experience this kind of disorder?
You know, it spans quite a few different kinds of disorders, and not all children will experience it the same way. You have functional dyspepsia, which is basically you just have upper abdominal pain, or you have irritable bowel syndrome, which is an example of how, you know, you get pain or discomfort associated with changes in stool frequency. And then some children will just have this generalized abdominal pain with no association with whether it's upper, it's just kind of there. And then you can actually get an abdominal migraine. So there's differences in the physical presentation of these disorders, as well as some of the psychosocial characteristics. Many of them are probably about 40% are just low distress. They are, you know, not that bothered by it. They're bothered enough to maybe go in, but they're not super anxious about it. You get another 40% who might be more, a little bit high on the anxiety side, tendency towards anxiety, maybe feeling a little bit distressed, having a little bit of functional impairment, and so they might need some additional help working through it. But then you have a smaller portion that actually is quite distressed, so both in terms of their physical symptoms and their emotional symptoms.
What's the connection to anxiety disorders, and does one cause the other?
Actually, they intersect. The functional gastrointestinal disorders intersect somewhere between the medical and the psychological. They really fall in between. They can operate on the same physiological levels. For example, you have more serotonin receptors in your gut than you have in your head. And so literally, there is a brain-gut connection. You also get the top-down, bottom-up kind of effect where, you know, your stomach may be experiencing, your abdominal area may be experiencing pain, and your nerves may be more sensitized to it physiologically. But then in your brain, the pain center, the gateway has kind of been open, so your increased attention to it will operate kind of bidirectionally. So there's a physiological connection. And then likewise, we know that, you know, stomach aches are often one of the most common presenting complaints in children with anxiety disorders, and so you can be associated with anxiety. Likewise, sometimes you can get a lot of anxiety associated with gastrointestinal distress, especially if they say, well, the doctor doesn't know what's going on. So then they start worrying about that, and then it impacts their school, their social functioning, and then they're worried about what's going to happen. Am I going to be able to make it through school? And what about my grades? And so you can get anxiety developing secondary to the symptoms themselves, and then sometimes depression as well. Because then they're depressed because they're not going to school, they're not seeing their friends, how long is this going to go on? And so a lot of times there can be some secondary anxiety, depression.
What can clinicians look for in children, and when is it appropriate to send the patient to a gastroenterologist rather than stick with a psychologist or another mental health professional?
I think typically whenever I would refer if there's just repeated symptoms that are not just solely triggered by stress or anxiety. So they may kind of get the symptoms out of the blue, they may wake up with the symptoms, or the symptoms are probably maybe more extreme or intense than what might be expected. So again, we know that some people just have kind of more sensitive stomachs than others, and so they might benefit from having some additional help from the gastroenterology or workup too, especially if they're starting to become very anxious about those symptoms. And it wouldn't be a function of, say, OCD, where they're just seeking reassurance. But if they truly have a lot of symptoms and they need some of that effective medical reassurance that, no, you really don't have a blood and pus disease, we know what's going on.
Before we talk about treatment, let me ask you, you mentioned OCD. Are there any particular anxiety disorders that are more associated with gastrointestinal disorders, or is that not really?
Not necessarily. Right. Typically, that you might see, the research kind of shows that you might get higher spikes of anxiety symptoms or depressive symptoms, but not always at a clinical level. Or if they do have anxiety disorders in general or other depressive disorders, that their functioning may not be as impairing or their symptoms as severe as you might get with somebody who's presenting initially with an anxiety or depressive disorder.
Okay. Let's move on to treatments. Can you talk about what kinds of treatments you found effective?
So cognitive behavioral therapy is one of the most effective treatments. There's been a lot of research certainly done in the adult literature, and there's been some research done in the pediatric literature as well. I feel like that's still in its infancy, but basic pain management techniques are often very helpful. So things like relaxation or biofeedback, with the stress of actually they need to practice those skills rather than just use them whenever they are feeling lots of pain. So that's one of the things sometimes kids will come to me and say, oh, I've tried that already. But the problem is they're only using their relaxation skills whenever they're in pain, and they're not really good at that. So then I say, so, well, you know, what would you expect to win out? And they're like, oh, okay. So we have to have them learn how to practice having parents give differential attention, because a lot of times it's fine when parents are attending to their symptoms, similar to even anxiety disorders. You know, you want to make your child feel better, but when it's a chronic condition, increased attention can actually reinforce both those physical and emotional symptoms. Cognitive restructuring, kind of looking at those thinking errors, helping them balance their thoughts out about, you know, if they're thinking, oh, well, this is the worst case ever, it's never going to get better, certainly that's going to affect their ability to cope with it. And also setting up some structure and behavioral contingencies so that they can practice the strategies that we're teaching them. That's often including parents in that, so that they can help structure the environment so that they can help.
So my next question was really, how can a patient and the patient's parents, what can they expect in treatment? So you've gone into that a little bit.
Right. So basically, we really stress how the patients or the children and parents are very active participants. Similar to anxiety, what's learned in the office needs to be practiced outside of session. And our goal is always, I can't get rid of those symptoms, because again, they're not abnormal per se symptoms, but the goal is to manage them. And when they manage them more effectively, then by default, a lot of times those symptoms actually decrease, almost as a byproduct of managing them well.
So that's what clinicians can tell their patients about what to expect as an outcome. Anything else? I know it varies individually, but any other?
They should expect that they should increase in functioning. Our focus is on increased functioning despite whatever their physical and emotional symptoms are. And usually we'll say it's anywhere from, it really can be 3 to 20 sessions depending on the severity and impact. Certainly if you've got a child who has stomach aches and stomach pain and is refusing school, that's going to take many more sessions than maybe somebody who just is starting and has some anxiety and really just needs some education and some basically coping tips. But it's much more, we kind of think of ourselves as coaches rather than you need to lie on the couch and have this long drawn out, but it's much more active. So we try to take some of that stigma of what's it going to be like to go talk to the psychologist. And it's also not all in their head. We're very clear about that, because we get that a lot is they worry that, oh, we've been referred to the psychologist, so they must think I'm making it up. And so we're very clear that we believe the symptoms are very real. And I use that quarterback example to help them understand that.
And what research do you see on the horizon?
Well, and as part of treatment, I think one of the other things I forgot to mention is it is helpful to have collaboration with the GI physician or a pediatrician if they're looking at that piece, so that you can have the effective medical reassurance of things. And sometimes it's very helpful to have some medicines can help with some of the functional GI disorders. So I think one of the things in terms of research is looking at, I think, some of that collaborative treatment. The collaborative treatment and looking at the effects of the cognitive behavioral therapy and which medications work, I think, would be really good in terms of the research. There's also some research on the horizon about looking at those physiological perceptions of those symptoms, of how you feel things. That's been more and more kind of looking into some of the what actually does happen So we have some hypotheses about that, but we're finding out more and more about how is that alteration in the body's sensations working.
So that's what you'd like to see in terms of future research, mm-hmm. or is there anything else on your wish list?
I think some of it is dissemination, because a lot of times the physicians are, it's medical. So, and if it's not medical, they're not really sure what to do with it. And so the collaboration process is very split. So I think just a dissemination of understanding of having these diagnoses and using these diagnoses effectively, and collaborating versus go see the shrink. I'd love to see that as just more broad-based, so that the patients kind of feel more able and more willing to kind of follow up with the psychological aspects of it.
Well, I'm sure the patients would like that too. So I hope that comes to fruition. Thank you very much, Dr. Danda. This
Thank
is
you.
Jean Kaplan-Tycro for ADAA.